shortly after the disobedience in Eden, Jehovah graciously gave Adam and Eve hope of deliverance. I think it was an indication of Jehovah's character, how quickly he gave them some hope. God promised them that the seed of the woman would bruise the serpent's head. Genesis 3:15. 2,000 years later, Jehovah made a direct statement to Abraham. In your seed will all the families of the earth be blessed. Genesis 22:18. And after another 2,000 years, the promise was fulfilled. The seed of promise was born. Jesus of Nazareth. He was the seed. They recognized him. The angels sang at his birth. And they said, "We have found the Messiah." He was the one who would end the degradation. He was the one that would end the economic problems, the social problems, the personal problems. He would end man's inhumanity to end. He was the Messiah. He would do away with every ramification of that original sin. After 4,000 years, 4,000 years of waiting, they could truly say, "We have found the Messiah. He is here. Observe what he is doing. Listen to his words. Look at this man." Even the Roman governor of Palestine said, "Behold the man." Then an incredible thing happened. This seed of promise was put to death. You see, this glorious fulfillment of the original promise had one aspect to it that no one understood, that no one was prepared for. Everyone assumed that the deliverer would immediately implement the deliverance. This was not the case. Please remember this concept when later we talk about the second presence. Everyone assumed that the deliverer would immediately implement the deliverance. This was not the case. In preparing his disciples for his departure, Jesus said he would come again to set up the kingdom. John 14, verse 3. "I will come again." But he told them, as far as the timing of the event, only his Father in heaven knew when it would take place. Matthew 24:36. And so the waiting began. It was almost like starting all over again. They had hope, but there was also confusion. And many lost faith. A very interesting thing happened about 20 years after our Lord's departure. It happened in northern Greece in the city of Thessalonica. Word spread that Jesus had returned. Wow! But this was a false report. And the Apostle Paul responded to this rumor by saying not only had it not happened, but he said, "Let me tell you some things that must transpire first before it can happen." Paul explained to the early church in his second letter to the Thessalonians that there would first be a great falling away from the truth. A false church would replace the true church. What an astounding prediction. An apostate system of Christianity would be developed. He said to them, something devastating is going to happen to the truth movement as you know it. All this would have to happen before Christ would return. This was a profound prophecy. The implication was delay. And this marked the beginning of almost 2,000 years of confusion on the subject of Christ's second coming. After the apostles died, the confusion grew. About 400 years after Jesus died, one of the greatest writers of the Catholic Church, Augustine, declared that Christ would return after the 1,000 years. Why would he come up with such an idea? Well, this fit better with their philosophy that the church on earth should rule over the state, and that the church and mankind should first implement control over the earth for 1,000 years, then Christ can come. This was became known as the post-millennial advent. Messiah would come post or after the millennium. This, of course, is in direct opposition to the view that Christ would first return, Christ would establish the kingdom, and then the millennium proceeds. Pre-millennial coming of Christ. Augustine had great impact. When we think of the time periods in which he lived and what ensued afterwards, it was a period of little intellectual activity. There was great belief in spiritism, dragons, witches, demons. Everything in the scriptures was taken literally. It's a good reason why they called this time period the Dark Ages. Christ's return was conceptualized as a literal return. Everything was literal. You would see Christ on a literal cloud, coming literally down, scorching the earth with literal fire, saving only literally a few of his followers. And of course, all this had to transpire in one literal 24-hour day. Totally overlooked was the concept that Christ was now a spirit being, that he could come and go as the wind. He could be there and not be seen. The Middle Ages exacerbated this literal approach. Again, everything was fire, dragons, rings of hellfire, boiling sulfur, superstition piled upon superstition. And in the middle of this time period was the year 1000. The year 1000 was a huge event in nominal church history. Based on the ideas of Augustine and the references of 1000 in the book of Revelation, there was great expectation that Christ's second presence would take place in the year 1000. The religious world was in an uproar in the year 1000. When 1000 passed and nothing happened, they latched onto the year 1313. This was a good year. It was a good year to predict. This was based on the fact that Constantine, in the year 313, in his Edict of Milan, issued the proclamation of religious freedom in the Roman Empire and said that Christianity would become the state religion. So, starting from that great proclamation of truth, quote-unquote, 1,000 years from there, their millennium, and expecting Christ to come at the end then of the 1,000 years, brought them to the year 1313. And the same hysteria that took place over the year 1000 happened in the year 1313. And you know what happened in the year 1313 regarding the Lord's second presence? Nothing. Now, I believe, as was alluded to earlier this week, that in the darkest of ages, there were those who had the truth. I believe they even had the truth about the second presence. And I think they would have held to the truth of the premillennial coming of Christ to set up the millennium. They wouldn't have agreed with Augustine and the official doctrine of the Catholic Church. But you know who controlled the thought of that time period. And it was really not until the 1600s that there is evidence that the idea of Christ coming first, then the millennium, started to be discussed and became popular. In a very enlightening article by Brother Hudson of England in the Bible Study Monthly of November 1977, he traces the history and the seeds of the ideas regarding the second presence. I found it to be an absolutely incredible article. It was in the 1600s that the ideas started to surface. Premillennial Christ's coming. And more astounding, at that early date, 1600s, they started to talk about the second coming having two aspects, that there was an invisible portion and then a visible portion of the second coming. Now, for 1600s, this is an extremely clear-sighted insight, that Christ could come in one manner and then have another phase, so to speak. So let's spend a minute or two on why it's so important to see that there are two phases to this coming, this presence. As we know, there are some scriptures that talk about Christ coming secretly. He's coming as a thief in the night. He comes without observation. We're told to watch for him carefully. In sharp contrast, there were all the scriptures that talked about every eye shall see him. The knowledge of the Lord will fill the earth as the waters cover the sea. There's a conflict here, let's be honest. This is secret. This is known to everybody. But now, it became clear. There could be two phases. One could be secret, and that could be followed by another second phase that was visible and clear to everyone. And to help confirm this doctrinal position of two phases, there were even different Greek words to substantiate a separation into parts. Parousia, the Greek word for presence, could represent being present, but has nothing to do with being seen or not seen. And in great contrast, the other Greek words of epiphania and apokalypsis mean inherently revealed, manifest, visible to all. So even the Greek words used in the scriptures lent credence to the two-phase interpretation. Three Greek words to describe two phases of Christ's second presence. Parousia means to be present. It's the opposite of being absent. In the New Testament, the word is very simply used to say, predict, prophesy, that Christ is here, present, parousia, no longer absent. In this position, he can do things. He can harvest his truth, his church. He can supervise activities here on earth. He can complete the 144,000. And even when the very visible manifestations of the kingdom take place, Christ is still present. So that word does not end, but it continues all the way through. Christ will be present through the entire mediatorial reign. As a matter of fact, the parousia will only end after Christ turns everything back to the Father, after the little season. So we can say that the parousia lasts over 1,000 years. The second and third Greek words, the epiphania and apokalypsis, they both refer to the very visible part of Christ's kingdom. The words mean to be revealed, to be manifest, visible. And they imply that in this second phase, everyone will be aware of Christ's kingdom. Let me divert for a moment. There was a thought presented early in the understanding of the harvest message, and then carried on later, that the revealment of these, that the interpretation of these three words really represented three phases of the presence. And the thought was that since the word epiphania meant revealed, this could perhaps be interpreted as being revealed to the church. So the thought was suggested a presence, a revealment to the small group, and then an apocalypsis revealing to everybody. It was a nice thought, but it's not how the word is used in the scriptures. If you look at every use of the word epiphania, every use of the word apocalypsis, you will see that it refers not to the church class, but to the world. And I can't say it any better than Brother Russell did in reprint 45-43, January 1910. Let me quote a few phrases. The article starts by saying this: "Notwithstanding all we have written on this subject, some appear not to fully comprehend it." Can you hear the frustration? Continuing, quote, "The parousia is to the church and for the church only. The epiphania or apocalypsis of the Lord is not to the church nor for the church, but to the world and for the world." Next paragraph. "Soon the bridegroom and bride will be ushered into the presence of the Father in eternal glory. The marriage supper of the Lamb will be celebrated, and then bride and bridegroom will come forth to bless the world. The crowning day of joy to the church will be followed by our Lord's epiphania." End of quote. Three Greek words describing two phases of Christ's presence. In Brother Hudson's article, he documents the history of the beliefs. He moves into the 1700s, and he tells us that in England in the 1820s, they had conventions specifically on the subject of the Second Advent. And in some of these conventions, thoughts were presented regarding the two phases of the kingdom. Thoughts were also presented regarding the great time of trouble, the period between the first phase and the second phase, which many of them thought would be just 7 years. And also thoughts were presented in these conventions regarding the regathering of Israel to the Holy Land. This is in the 1820s in England. In 1834, there were 6 regular journals being printed in England regarding the Second Advent. And 60 books had been published on the subject to that time. These things were happening in England. Similar things were happening in the United States. William Miller was starting his movement. I had always thought that Miller was a stepping stone for Brother Russell's understanding of the Second Presence. But compared to what was understood in England, the two phases, the things I just mentioned, Miller was a giant step backwards. Miller believed in a literal descent from heaven of Christ on a cloud. He literally believed you had to go on the highest mountain to meet the descending Christ. He thought that there would be a literal day of judgment and then the destruction of all things on the earth. There was nothing in his preachings regarding those two phases, which are so important to the understanding. Miller expected all this to happen in 1844. When 1844 came and went, then some of the Adventists began to wake up again to the concept of the two phases of the kingdom. In 1870, Nelson Barber and William Patton, co-editors of the Adventist journal, The Midnight Cry, published a view that Christ was coming in two phases. 1870. They said the first phase was unseen. They said the second phase would be visible to the entire world. They expected that the second presence would occur in 1874. 6 years later, from their start, in 1876, they were joined by a young man named Charles Russell. He was 24 years old at this point. And briefly stated, what Brother Russell added to this understanding of the two phases of the Second Presence was the concept of restitution. The concept that the 1,000 years was the time period of rehabilitation, of education, and restitution, and that it was not the destruction of the earth. That's what Charles Russell added to this growing understanding of the concept of the Second Presence. And of course, it was at this point that he began the organization which we call the Bible Student Movement, of which we have all been beneficiaries. So the understanding 100 years ago briefly was this. There would be two phases of the return. One secret, one very visible. And the belief was that this would begin and happen in 1874. The big question is, that was 100 years ago. Where do we stand today? Well, first of all, I think it's clear and very reasonable that there are two phases to the second coming, the second presence. It helps us separate all the scriptures on the second presence into two piles. The ones that refer to the secret presence, and then later, the ones that refer to the great manifestation to the world. Two phases? All right, we can agree on that. But still then, the question is, where are we on the stream of time? Well, I think it's obvious we're not in the second phase, where every eye shall see him, and the word of the Lord will cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. We're definitely not there. If the second presence has occurred at all, the only option is that we're in the secret, the first phase. So the question then comes, has the first phase happened? Well, Jesus gave us signs. One of the classic places for the signs is listed in Matthew 24. It's also in Luke 21. And as we look at these signs in evidences, it very quickly becomes evident that Jesus spoke on this subject just like he did on all his other subjects, and that means he used pictures and parables. The signs that Jesus talked about are parabolic. They need to be figured out. They need to be thought out. They need to be deciphered. It's not simple. As I look at the signs, I have to be honest. Some appeal to me much more than others. And as I looked at them, and you know, it's most important to be honest in this belief. There's no value, there's no pleasure in Jehovah's eyes if you believe in the second presence because Brother Russell said so. There's no value in Jehovah's eyes if you believe in the second presence because your parents taught you that. You must believe it for yourself. So as I looked at all the signs of the second presence, I said, I can see different kinds of signs. And I roughly came up with four categories. The first kind of sign of the second presence, I have given the rather uncomplimentary label of ambiguous signs. Now these signs will be true during his presence. They're true signs. Make no mistake, these are true signs of his presence. But you know, it seems to me that they've always been true. Example from Matthew 24. Nation shall rise up against nation. When has that not been true? Example from Matthew 24. The church class will be persecuted. When has that not been true? And in the past, more than perhaps now. So we can see that they can be an evidence of his presence, but I find them ambiguous, unclear. Category number one. Category number two, gradual developing signs. Again, when they're here, you can see the sign. It's a terrific proof of Christ's second presence. But I can't exactly tell you when it started. In this category is one of my favorite proofs. The increase of knowledge. The increase of knowledge is here. It's phenomenal. It's an evidence that Christ is present. I can't exactly tell you when it started. I used to think it started in the late 1800s. History does not support that. There are so many inventions in the 1700s that helped mankind. The steam engine, winnowing, flying shuttle looms impacted greatly. The increase of knowledge started long time ago with big dramatic things. The Industrial Revolution had to be part of the increase of knowledge. When did that start? 1760s. So I see the increase of knowledge as a clear sign of Christ's presence. I can't tell you exactly when it started. So category two are the positive signs, but I can't tell you exactly when they started. The third category of signs are those of chronology. Numbers, dates, multiplications, divisions to arrive at a time period. Jesus did not use this kind of proof, evidence. It's not in his teachings. Historically, you know that they've been greatly misused. We all have mathematicians buried inside us, though, and we want to calculate those numbers out. But we cannot live by that kind of faith. The fourth category, these are the ones that we're looking for. These are the ones where something would be so dramatic, the change would be so definite, it would happen in such a short time period, these would be black and white changes. These are the undeniable ones. That's what we're looking for. In this group, I have three favorites. Number one, and you know, the great challenge of this subject is to bring together something that we could spend months talking about. Number one, the restoration of Israel. There are hundreds of scriptures that tie the restoration of Israel, the rebirth of Israel, with the presence of Messiah and the establishment of the kingdom. Matthew 24 says that the fig tree will bud as one of the signs of the parousia, and the fig tree is a classical symbol of the nation of Israel. The restoration of Israel is a black and white proof of Christ's return, of Christ's presence. 100 years ago, virtually no nation of Israel. Now, a world power. 2,500 years ago, no nation of Israel. Destroyed off the face of the earth for 2,500 years. Now, they're there. The bones are rattling. Could this happen again? Could there be this huge migration of Jews to Israel again? It's impossible. They'd have to be scattered back to the four corners of the wind, to the earth. Then they'd have to be brought back again. There'd have to be another Holocaust. Brethren, it's already happened. You can't deny what's happened to Israel. It's a massive proof of Christ's presence here. Moving along quickly, the second proof in my mind is the end of the Gentile times. This is based on the dream in Daniel 2, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar. The image in that dream was smitten in 1914 with World War I. The world was changed in 1914. Every historian will tell you that. Now the scientists, the psychologists are adding in, and they're saying our individual scientific worlds also changed at that time. They give credit to Freud in the field of psychology. They say that Newtonian physics was replaced by Einstein. The world changed. The divine right of kings was ended. Before 1914, four or five countries ruled the world. Four or five families, four or five men ruled the world. 1914, tremendous explosion. The image is smitten. And what happened after it? The common man rose up. Every man has a vote now. Every man and woman has a vote now. Some brethren are in a holding pattern about this. And they're in a holding pattern because Brother Russell said 100 years ago that the stone is Christ and the church. That was his view 100 years ago. The stone, the picture, is a picture of dominion. This is not Christ coming down and hitting these things. What happens to the stone? It stays here on earth. Christ is in heaven. The stone grows into the earthly kingdom. Christ doesn't stay here. The church doesn't stay here. He's in the heavens. What this picture is talking about is dominion. In 1914, the king's dominion ended. Christ's dominion began. This is a massive proof of his presence. The third proof is something we call the harvest. The harvest, the parable says that at the end of the age, the wheat would be gathered, the tares would be bundled and burned. First of all, what happened in the harvest picture was that the truths, those seeds of truth that started back in 1600 and in other places that were scattered and no one knew what to do with, were brought together in the harvest message. And the second phenomenon that took place in this time period was that it was time now for the wheat to come out of Babylon. Revelation 18:4. And so they came out. They came out by the thousands. People that had been under the suppression of the papal mind control for thousands of years came out. Did your grandparents come out of that system? Yes, mine did. Common people stood up to the priesthoods of every denomination. They came out of the denominations. Could this ever happen again on such a scale? Could there be a bringing together of truth again in such a concise manner? And coming out of the nominal systems again by such numbers? It's impossible to happen again. It already happened. You cannot deny it. Israel, 1914, the world changed. 3, the harvest of the gospel age. And what's so phenomenal is that these three things happened virtually at the same time. That's the miracle, the timing at the same time. A Bible student friend of mine said to me, "What difference does it make if Christ is present or not? I'm the same person. I believe the same things. I have the same character." Well, first of all, my good friend, you wouldn't have these truths so clearly defined if it weren't for the presence of the Lord. The reason the truths are so clearly defined and you understand them is that was the meat in due season. He says to me, "How would my life be different?" My answer is, look to the first advent. If you were here when Jesus walked on the earth the first time, would you have taken the lessons from him, learned from him, loved him, and then said, "I have an understanding now, I have a new character now, it makes no difference whether this man is here or not"? Oh no. If you learned all those things from Jesus of Nazareth as he walked on the face of the earth, you would have said to your friends, "We have found the Messiah." That's what you would have done. I know you would have done it. So, that's what we are to do also. Now, the story gets better, because we've talked about the unseen portion, but my dear brethren, there is a visible portion coming. And I must tell you one account or story of how the Greek word epiphania was used in the days of the apostles. And if you don't remember anything else that I said tonight, I hope you will remember this account. The Greeks loved their theater. They built huge amphitheaters, and they would go there to see the plays and the dramas and the tragedies of writers like Aeschylus, Sophocles, Euripides, and Aristophanes. These were great Greek playwrights. Most of the plays were tragedies. And they were incredibly complicated, convoluted stories like Oedipus Rex. You may remember some of the storyline of Oedipus Rex. He separated from his parents at an early age. Later on, unbeknownst to him, he meets and kills his father. Later on, unbeknownst to him, he meets and marries his mother. These are the kind of stories that all these Greek playwrights wrote. They were so complicated, and they were so disastrous that... Okay, I know, the parousia of the chairman has happened here. I must finish this story. These stories were so complicated, there was no way out. These were the extremities of life's dilemmas. Picture this on the Greek stage. Everything was a disaster. It was hopeless. Then came the part in the play called the Epiphania. And the Epiphania was the appearance of a god on the stage, usually Apollo. And not only would he appear, but let me tell you that most of the times he was already on the stage in a disguise. But at the Epiphania, he took off the mask and he solved the problems of this tragedy. And it had a happy ending. The Greeks loved it. Do you see why the apostles used the word Epiphania? Every school child knew that it meant the solution. It's not Apollo, though. It's Christ, head and body. If you understand this concept, believe me, brethren, I believe it is an indication that you have a very strong possibility of running for the prize of the high calling. You have the opportunity of being part of the 144,000. If you understand that He has returned and that an Epiphania is in the near future. So lay aside every weight, whether it's an organizational weight, an ecclesial weight, a family weight, a personal weight. Lay aside the weights that you can be part of the instrumentality that brings to this earth the original intent of God in the Garden of Eden. Run for the prize. May God help you do so.